Didn't even hear it yet. That's already okay. Good morning. We mostly know what we're doing up here. The raising of Lazarus. John just read about it from John chapter 11. The raising of Lazarus is the last and greatest of the seven signs found in the book of signs contained within the first half of the gospel, according to John. It constitutes the high point of Jesus' work in the world. It also foreshadows Jesus' own death and resurrection, as well as triggers his opposition's resolve to take official action to kill him. Some object to this story of Lazarus because they claim it is not historical, and they say that because it's not found in the Synoptic Gospels. The term Synoptic Gospels refers to Matthew, Mark, and Luke. Synoptic means to see with the same point of view, see with the same eye. And Matthew, Mark, and Luke chronicle similar events in a similar sequence, so they are referred to as the Synoptic Gospels. Okay, so some claim this story of Lazarus is not true because it's not found in the Synoptic Gospels. However, the Synoptic Gospels tend to focus on Jesus' Galilean ministry in the north. Only one of their miracles is found anywhere near Jerusalem. John, on the other hand, is mostly concerned about Jesus' Judean ministry in the south. Lazarus lived in Bethany, 2 miles near, just outside of Jerusalem in Judea. Furthermore, there are three resurrection-like stories in the Gospels, not just one, but three. Two are in the Synoptic Gospels and take place in Galilee. So it makes sense that the Synoptic Gospels would cover these events that took place in Galilee. One of the three takes place in the south, in Judea. So it makes sense that John covers the one that took place in the south. The Synoptics are somewhat vague about why Jesus was put to death. But John offers a detailed and plausible account of the political considerations that led to Jesus' execution. There are four scenes to this story, the fourth of which deals with the plot to kill Jesus. For our purposes this morning, we'll be focusing on the first three scenes, as they have to do with the miraculous sign itself. Each of these scenes, each of these three scenes, has a misdirect, a conditional sentence that, even if it were true, totally misses the point. All right, first scene has Jesus east of the Jordan River. The misdirect is this: if Lazarus is sleeping, that means he's getting better, and we don't need to go visit him. John identifies the location where Jesus is located by saying it was where John the Baptist had been baptizing. Now, he could have just named the location instead of this sort of convoluted way of describing location, but he may have done that because if he had named the location, people would have gotten confused. Jesus is in Bethany. His close friends, Lazarus, Martha, and Mary, live in Bethany. When Lazarus gets ill, the sisters send a messenger who would have had to have taken at least a day's journey to meet up with Jesus. Did I mention that Jesus is in Bethany? The messenger came from Bethany. Are you confused? Well, I'm going to help you, but first I have to confuse you even more. How many of you know I was born in Portage? How many of you know I was born in Portage? Now, I didn't grow up in Portage, but I actually was born in Portage. I grew up in a town about 60 miles away from Portage called Wisconsin Dells. And some of you are thinking, oh, wait a minute. Wisconsin Dells is in Wisconsin, and it's a heck of a lot more than 60 miles from Portage to Wisconsin Dells. No, it's not. The confusion lies in the fact we have two towns with the same name. You are familiar with Portage, Michigan, just down the road. I was born in Portage, Wisconsin. There are two Bethanies mentioned in the Bible, two towns with the same name. Bethany of Perea, which was east of the Jordan River, and Bethany of Judea, just outside of Jerusalem. Lazarus, Mary, and Martha live in Bethany of Judea. They send a messenger to find Jesus, who is in Bethany of Perea. Follow that? All right. There are also two men named Lazarus in the Gospels, okay? The other one is mentioned in Jesus' parable, sometimes referred to as the parable of Lazarus and the rich man. But apart from the reference to death and the same name, these are two different stories, two different people. Lazarus was a very common name in the first century, very common. And it was actually a nickname from Eleazar, meaning God is my help. In any case, it's clear that Lazarus, Martha, and Mary are close friends of Jesus. And John assumes that the readers already know about Mary and Martha, perhaps from reading one of the other Gospels, or because of Mary's reputation for having been the one who poured expensive perfume on the Lord's feet and wiped them with her hair. There are two facts here which are in opposition to each other. Fact one, Jesus loved Lazarus. Well, he loved Mary and Martha also. Jesus loved Lazarus. Fact two, he deliberately delayed 2 days before going to see Lazarus. That doesn't seem to make sense. The only way it would seem to make sense is if Jesus already knew that Lazarus was dead. How so? Well, let me point out that by the time Jesus does arrive, they tell him Lazarus has been dead 4 days. So even if he had left immediately, he still would not have arrived before Lazarus died. All right. So nothing would have been gained by an immediate departure, but something might have been gained by a delay. It was popularly thought that the spirit of the deceased hovered around the body for 3 days and then departed. So after 3 days, the person was considered really dead. Okay, I know that's not really a technical. Really dead. So after 4 days, that would make it very clear. So whatever Jesus did, it would really demonstrate the power and glory of God. Jesus then seems to have delayed in order to make it clear that Lazarus is good and dead, and then anything happens is truly remarkable. And he would hope to strengthen the sisters' faith and that of his disciples. Jesus declares, Lazarus' sickness will not end in death. No, It happened for the glory of God, so that the Son of God will receive glory from this. Now, the disciples are glad for the delay. They don't want to go back to Judea. Because the last time they were in Judea, the crowds were kind of hostile. And in anger, were throwing rocks at them. Well, they were throwing at Jesus, but, you know, guilt by association. And they were afraid. They didn't want to go back. But Jesus then says, "Our friend Lazarus has fallen asleep, but now I will go and wake him up." And this then prompts the misdirect. If Lazarus is sleeping, then that means he's getting better, and we don't need to visit him. Now, Jesus is using sleep as a euphemism for death. So then he has to explain in plain language, Lazarus is dead. And then to the chagrin and horror of the disciples, he tells them he is headed back to Judea. Thomas, expressing a mixture of resignation and loyalty, says, "Let's go too and die with Jesus." For John, the underlying message is that Jesus is willing to risk his life for his friends, foreshadowing and anticipating his sacrifice on the cross. John alone remembered and wrote down what Jesus said on the matter. "There is no greater love than to lay down one's life for one's friends." It is in the cross we discover that God has the greatest possible love for us and wants us to be his friends. Scene 2. In the second scene, Jesus arrives at Bethany of Judea. And the misdirect here is, "If you had been here, none of this would have happened." Jesus came upon what to us would have seemed like a noisy and confusing situation. It was customary then to pay for professional mourners. Everybody was expected to do this. In the Mishnah, the written down oral tradition about the law, we read, "Even the poorest in Israel should hire not less than 2 flutes and 1 wailing woman." That's if you were poor. Mary and Martha were rich. Family members customarily would stay in the house for a full week after the funeral, which typically took place one day after death. A practice that continues to the present in conservative and Orthodox Jewish families. Martha and Mary were well off, they were well liked, there were many familiar visitors and well-wishers, but there was also an awful lot of people there who didn't even know the family. Richard Henry, the late proprietor of the Richard A. Henry Funeral Home here in Battle Creek, once told me a story about Al Wienick, who was the lead pastor here at First Presbyterian Church for 25 years. Anyway, Dick told me he called on Dr. Wienick to do a last-minute funeral at Henry Funeral Home, and Dr. Wienick agreed, but he did not know the deceased. And because of the ambiguity of the name, he didn't even know the gender of the person who had died. But he thought of a clever way to resolve that. Right before the service started, he went up to the front row where he presumed members of the family were seated. He bent over and whispered, "Brother or sister?" There was a pause, and then they said, "Cousin." Anyway, as I noted earlier, the family was supposed to stay in the house for a week. But as we see in this passage, Martha, true to her nature, hears that Jesus is coming. She leaves the house and goes to meet him. Her first words are, "Lord, if only you'd been here, my brother would not have died." Jesus tells her that her brother will rise again. Then he makes one of those claims that either place him on the throne or in an asylum. "I am the resurrection and the life. Anyone who believes in me will live, even after dying. Everyone who lives in me and believes in me will never, ever die. Do you believe this, Martha?" Martha says she does. But it is clear from the context she really doesn't understand what he has said. In the discussion that follows, Martha expresses belief in the resurrection and even belief that Jesus is the expected Messiah. But her beliefs are shaped more by popular expectation within her religion than they are on what Jesus actually said. The common, but by no means universal belief at this time in history for Judaism was that the dead would raise bodily at the end of time. Also, that the Messiah, when the Messiah comes, will be able to heal the sick. But nothing is mentioned of raising the dead. Hence, Martha's disappointment in Jesus for not having arrived sooner. Jesus also wants to see Mary. Martha goes to get Mary. Mary comes out in a typical Mary fashion, kneels before Jesus, and then unwittingly says the same thing her sister said, "Lord, if only you'd been here, my brother would not have died." And the crowd builds on the sister's complaint, saying, in effect, "If only you had been here." When we face disappointments, when we face painful struggles, we're tempted to make the same complaint. "Oh God, if only you had, then this wouldn't have happened." And we don't usually blame God for causing the bad thing. What we usually do is we're angry with God because we believe God could have prevented that bad thing and don't understand why he doesn't match our expectations. Jesus has a strong emotional response, very difficult to translate into English. At first, he seems angry, but then expresses great tenderness. This is captured in the shortest verse in the entire Bible, John 11:35. Those of you who had difficulty memorizing Scripture should not have a problem memorizing John 11:35. Two words, Jesus wept. Literally, burst into tears. But these are not the tears of the professional mourner. These are real. Jesus feels our pain. His empathy is genuine. Lloyd Ogilvie makes this observation. Notice how tenderly Jesus meets each of these sisters who are so different. He meets one with words of life and the other with wordless acceptance. So he meets each of us, where we are with our needs and with what little faith we have. Scene 3. Jesus is at the tomb of Lazarus. The misdirect here is, if you open that tomb, it's going to really stink. People were often buried in natural or man-made caves, especially if they came from families of means. A disc-shaped stone would be rolled into a groove before the entrance, blocking the entrance and protecting the remains from animals and even grave robbers. The deceased will be wrapped in cloth strips and laid on the floor. After a year, when the flesh had completely rotted off the bones, the family would return, collect the bones, put them in a box, and then slide it into a slot in the wall. Lazarus had been dead 4 days, and we know from later in the chapter that it was no longer winter, so decomposition was well underway. Nevertheless, Jesus says, "Roll the stone aside." Martha says what everybody else was thinking. If you open that tomb, it's going to really stink. But this concern about the stench is a misdirection. It keeps us from recognizing the assumption that's being made here, that Lazarus is gone. Remember, I said they believed that the soul left after 3 days. And this has been 4 days. The original Greek has no personal pronoun. They tell Jesus, "It has been dead 4 days." It, not he. Jesus reminds them of his promise, "You will see the glory of God." But they don't grasp what he's getting at. It's beyond their imagination, and like all such encounters with God's glory, well beyond their comfort zone. Same is true of us. There was a retired pastor who became a part-time minister of visitation for a church. One day he was visiting an older woman confined to a wheelchair who was in a nursing home. Before he left, the woman asked him to say a prayer. So this retired pastor asked God to give this woman comfort, strength, and healing. He was about to leave when he noticed that the woman's face began to glow. And she said, "Pastor, wait a second. Would you help me to my feet?" He didn't know what else to do, so he helped her to her feet. Then she took a few tentative steps. And then she started jumping up and down. And she started to dance. And she shouted. And she was crying tears of happiness. And the entire place was in an uproar. Well, eventually, she got quieted down. This retired pastor hurried off to his car, closed the door, gripped the steering wheel, and said this little prayer. "Lord, don't ever do that to me again." So the stone is rolled away. Jesus prays aloud for the benefit of those who are around him. Then in a commanding voice, he says, "Lazarus, come out." And the dead man came out. Never have more astonishing words been uttered in the history of the human race. So the dead man came out, his hands and feet bound in grave clothes, his face wrapped in a headcloth. Jesus told them, "Unwrap him and let him go." So here in this seventh sign, the glory of God is displayed in Jesus in the fullest and most authentic way. So John wasn't kidding when earlier he said, "We have seen his glory." But Jesus does not bask in the moment. He's concerned for Lazarus. His concern is practical and personal. And so he says, "Would someone please help Lazarus out of that mummy costume?" Oh, okay, he didn't quite say it that way. But this establishes a paradigm then for the community of faith today. It's Jesus' job to raise the dead. It's our job to unwrap them. I certainly think Jesus was capable of freeing Lazarus from his shroud, but for some reason he wants the community to do it. the stinky, messy job of removing the grave clothes. Jesus alone can conquer death. It is our job to show people how to live. His is the power, ours is the service. A Presbyterian minister by the name of Tara Witter Lehman makes this comment. Maybe this story is a call for us to roll up our sleeves and roll away anything that blocks us from seeing those trapped or hidden away in places of death. Maybe it's a charge to unbind and let go all those bound up in institutions, relationships, systems, beliefs, and attitudes that lead to death. Just maybe this story is a commission to bear the image of God in Christ, the one who, in life and in death, is a God both with us and for us. It is amazing to watch Jesus call people out of spiritual death into new life. I never get tired of seeing it. And I've also had the privilege of seeing loving Christ followers welcome these new believers, introduce them to new friends, to teach them the means of grace and call forth their gifts for ministry. In other words, they unwrapped their grave clothes. Now, John does not tell us what happened to Lazarus after this event. Eugene O'Neill wrote a play called Lazarus Laughs, and it depicts Lazarus after he has come out of the tomb and Jesus is no longer on the scene. As the title suggests, O'Neill's Lazarus laughs. He laughs all the time. He doesn't stop laughing. And this greatly annoys his enemies who try to intimidate him to be quiet. But Lazarus is unafraid. He has faced the worst that the world has to throw at him. Death. And death lost. Jesus said, I am the resurrection and the life. Those who believe in me, even though they die, yet shall they live. And those who live and believe in me shall never die. Do you believe this?